Episode 203 von Winter Day Hockey O'Clock. Michelle Laflamme, World Para Ice Hockey Senior Manager. We're about to quote-unquote celebrate the Equal Play Day. That's a day that was kind of founded or brought to life by this podcast's main sponsor, Winter Day. It's the day where women in sports are invisible until the end of the year when compared to men's sports. So basically 14% of sports coverage is about women's sports. Only 1% of the sports coverage is about para-athletes. So their equal play day happens basically at the very beginning of the year. And we're talking about growth and we're talking about exposure. And we're trying to help create an understanding of the para ice hockey movement, but what are your measures of success in terms of growth of the sport? Is it just the sheer countries that are participating, or is it indeed about viewers on broadcast?
So, of course, we would like, for us, it's an easy number to get, is a number of athletes, a number of countries. So that's for us. And also, again, our sport is to grow the sport, to get more athletes involved in the sport. That being said, it would be nice, and it should be, that the spectators may not have, like I said earlier in the podcast, they may not have a skin in the game. So right now, our community, or the people who are mainly involved or following the sport, I'm not saying all of them are, but the majority are, the majority of the people that are following the sport is because they know someone in the sport, right? They know, whether it's a brother or cousin, or they know somebody's nephew or niece that is playing the sport. That's how they get involved with the sport. The casual hockey fan, or maybe like an NHL fan that doesn't know anybody in para ice hockey or in para sports, may not be following the sport. And for us, what it's hilarious is that when you show those, I call them casual hockey fan, or your generic hockey fan, when you show them para ice hockey, their first reaction is always, oh, it's just like ice hockey. And you're like, yeah, it's just like ice hockey.
Win today, hockey.
In diesem Augenblick wird's jetzt richtig hitzig. Yeah, und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie.
Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Das ist unglaublich, was die vier zelebrieren.
Nice move, another nice move.
Oh, it's gone. Oh, what a goal. It doesn't get any better than this.
This is an episode of Winter Day Hockey O'Clock that I've been looking forward to for a very long time. I'm finally getting a lot of answers about the world of para ice hockey, and there's no one better suited than Michelle Laflamme, the World Para Ice Hockey Senior Manager, to talk about everything that deals with the setup of para ice hockey worldwide. And I'm really, really happy, Ms. Laflamme, that you could take a little bit of your valuable time to guest here on Winter Day Hockey O'Clock.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm really looking forward to sharing as much para ice hockey information as I can. It's a great program that you have, and the more people can learn about the sport, the better it is, right?
Most definitely. And I have to give a shout out at the very start of the podcast for a great assist in getting you on the program, because Michael Sauer, who previously guested here on Winter Day Hockey O'Clock as well, who's one of the beacons in terms of para ice hockey in Austria, he connected us and he made sure that I'm finally getting to the very top of how para ice hockey is set up worldwide. So let's just start very basic, maybe for listeners who just stumbled upon the program and have never heard of para ice hockey. I doubt they never heard of it, but maybe there's a listener or two out there. What does a World Para Ice Hockey Senior Manager do?
That's a great question. I'm sure a lot of people, even our members, are asking what I do. But for us, the way it's structured, the World Para Ice Hockey is the international federation of the sport that is para ice hockey. So in my role, really, the key component would be to assist with the growth of the sport as much as possible internationally, and then also oversee any of the events that are happening around the world. So all of our world championships, We also work with forming, recruiting, onboarding, training the on-ice officials, the off-ice officials. We do the appointments to tournaments, right? So we do all of this. And then as much as possible, we try to also help with grassroots initiatives. So we host development camps, we host officiating courses as well. So it's really the entirety of managing the International Federation.
I want to get to a granular level in a bit with you talking about the on-ice officials, the off-ice officials. And granted, it's very different than the world of ice hockey and the IIHF. But you being the World Para Ice Hockey Senior Manager, are there intersections, are there cooperations with the IIHF, or are these two separate governing entities?
Yes, we are 100% separate governing bodies. So the IIHF does stand-up hockey, that like we like to call it, and then we do para-ice hockey. So whenever you are sitting on a sledge and you're competing, whether it's at the international levels or you're doing grassroots initiatives, this falls under para-ice hockey, world para-ice hockey. So that being said, there is still some communications between the two organizations. We're lucky to have had good collaboration in the past, whether it is with the recruitment of on-ice officials, like referee, linesperson. We're able to count on the support of the officiating group over at the IIHF to put name forwards or to include us in discussions that we can recruit, hopefully, the best of the best out of their pool of experience. On-ice officials. Same thing for off-ice officials. We've been able to rely on them to provide us access to their results system. So all of our stats and data that we gather at World Championships, it's through the help of the IIHF. So like I said, very much different organization, different members, different rules, quite similar, but still different. So we operate completely independently from the IIHF. We are still under the governance of the International Paralympic Committee. So officially, our members are national Paralympic members and not national ice hockey federations, for example.
Is there ever a time where you might attend an IIHF tournament just to see how they do certain things, just to gather more input that helps your work?
So since I've started in this role, we haven't had the opportunity to go and observe each other's championship for several reasons. One of them, you know, being COVID. I've been in this post since 2020. So the first 3 years were very much focused on getting our world championships done, basically delivered very safely under strict restrictions, but also about growing the game. So, in this role, I have not attended IIHF event, but in my previous role, where I was working with Hockey Canada, I was actually working for the World Juniors. So whenever the IIHF would come to town, or whenever they would come to Canada, I would be on the organizing committee. So I do have some experience at seeing how they deliver event and what their requirements are and expectations. So that's something that I tried to bring to World Power Ice Hockey when I transitioned into this role in 2020.
And the World Juniors, they are a tremendously big deal, and it hasn't trickled down to all the hockey circles yet. But if you talk to insiders and longtime observers of the game, and it's finally going to change with the upcoming Olympics, that there is going to be a best on best tournament. But the past decade, the only best on best tournament that has happened was the World Juniors. What are certain learnings, observations that you made during your time working for Hockey Canada and being at the World Juniors that are helping you, have helped you, and are still helping you in your day job now?
I mean, it's the best school I could have gone to, really, because I was able to see the way the IIHF works behind the scene and also the level of professionalism requires to deliver such events. So whenever it comes to Canada, those are one of the biggest events in the country for that year. So we're talking 20,000, 23,000 plus people in the building. We're talking, you know, it takes a year to plan. It's the countries are in town for nearly a full month. So it's all hand on decks. It's very physically and mentally demanding, but it also shows you what is required to deliver at the highest level. So I think what I brought into my role when I got here was that that experience, because sometimes at the para ice hockey level or even in any para sports, you compare yourself to stand up equivalent or to your Olympic equivalent. So I was able to say, actually, at the IHF, you may think this is how it works, but this isn't the case. So it was able to draw parallels and give more education to the members that were already part of our community that had maybe no experience working with the IHF directly. So I think that was one of the thing that was the most beneficial, was just that transfer of knowledge to set expectations, but also see what can be done at our level, just elevating the professionalism, the importance of following rules and regulations, but also being able to work in our reality. Because as much as we would like to deliver, you know, the type of event that we deliver at World Juniors, we're not working with the same budgets, not working with the same pool of athletes, because, for example, the IHF is in dozen and dozen and dozen of countries. We are in 19 countries, World Para Ice Hockey. So we have a smaller pool of teams to work with. So it's all about sharing experience, sharing knowledge, and making sure that the teams get to the highest performance that they can be. We can aspire to be, we should thrive and we should really aim to be as great as possible, but we also need to work with the structure that we're in. And sometimes, you know, it's just having those frank and honest conversation with our members that we have to find what is best for us and make it work.
Of course, the IHF has more countries and federations that they're working with, but 19 is still a lot. How long did it take you to get a full grasp on everything that's on your table? And granted the fact that you were, quote unquote, lucky enough to start in 2020 with COVID, making a mess out of everything. How long did it take to really understand everything about para ice hockey?
I was comfortable with the Paralympic movement. I knew about it. I knew about ice hockey. I knew what I could transfer the skills quite easily. Now, what's interesting is that, yes, I did start in 2020 during COVID, but we also saw a rapid growth in our membership. So when I started, we had 14 teams in 2020. Now we've had a growth of 50%. So now we are in 19 countries, but then we've also added women's teams to the program, which we didn't have before. So although there were some challenges at the beginning, we were still able to grow the game and growing rapidly in non-specifically ice hockey market. So we've been able to grow strongly in Asia, for example, which is they are involved in IHF tournament as well, but maybe not to the level that they are at in our sport. So in para ice hockey, we have China that's been extremely dominant for many years now. We have Japan, who's consistently being able to perform. Korea is another country. We've had Thailand that basically had no team, no ice rink, no program in 2020.
And hosting a tournament.
They've hosted twice. The last tournament, for those who have seen it, the first tournament, like I said, it was their first time playing international ice hockey. They hosted us spectacularly. They were great hosts, very gracious, very hospitable. So they delivered an amazing tournament in 2022. Their hockey IQ was, you know, a bit behind, which is normal for a team that had only been playing for less than 2 years. But we came back in 2024. So we came back last December, and their hockey skills have improved greatly. They almost won. They lost by one goal against Finland in the gold medal game, where the Queen of Thailand was present to watch the national team perform. So they've been spectacular. They've been great. We've also have Kazakhstan, who again in 2020 didn't have a team. They reached out to us. They've asked how they could get the program started. I gave them as much information as possible. We tried to keep in touch and monitor their progress. They showed up to the World Championship in Thailand. They were able to be promoted to the B pool, and they've hosted. Then they went on to host the following B pool, remain in the B pool. So in 5 years, they went to not having a program to being promoted and remaining in our second level, basically championship. So we've had great countries really stepping up and wanting to get involved with the movement. And those are the ones that are currently in our ranking, but we're also having conversations with programs in Brazil that are starting. There are programs in India that are starting. We have people in Turkey, in New Zealand that have reached out to us because they're interested in starting those programs. So like I mentioned initially, our members are the National Paralympic Committee. So it's not just a club thing where if you have a team in your local club, you can go in and become part of our world championships. There are different level of governance that needs to be respected and followed, but it gives us hope that really the sport is growing in those markets. So it gives us a chance to introduce those individuals with their National Paralympic Committee and try to facilitate a relationship with them so that they can grow the game. So, for example, recently we had a development camp in Slovakia. And the format of our development camp is we bring in athletes, we bring in nations that are already in our existing program. So we try to bring one team from the A pool, the B pool, the C pool, and then we bring in countries that currently don't have a program. We want them to form strong relationships within a certain region. So that way, when World Para Ice Hockey leaves the camp, the coaches, the players know who they can call if they need advice, if they want to do friendly games, if they want to do additional training camps. So this year in Slovakia, we were made aware that there was a group in Ukraine that wanted to start their program. They didn't know how to get that going. So we introduced them to the National Paralympic Committee of Ukraine, which they were able to come to an understanding that, yes, they would endorse their participation at the camps. So they came to Slovakia in November. There were six athletes. They had never played before. They were phenomenal on the ice. They were proper athletes. They came out. I think all the coaches on site were very impressed with their work. That they went back to Ukraine. They continued their training. They purchased equipment. They were six in November when we had the camp. The last time I talked to them last week, they were up to 12 athletes. So they're almost double. You know, they've doubled, and now they could technically have a national team ready to compete at the next event. So it's all about really community at our sports and introducing the right people to each other and making sure that we can give them the support and the knowledge that they need to continue in their path.
But just to fully understand this process is not a one-way street that the Paralympic federations always have to approach you. You're actively looking out for like countries that are developing a para ice hockey team. Are you looking at different markets? How does it work? Is it a one way street or is it a two sided or a two part process?
Yeah, I think for me when I started, it was very important. I say you need to have skin in the game. So there was there are organizations. What they do is that they pick a market and then they say, okay, let's try to grow this market. So the level of interest is unknown. So you take a gamble by going to a country and say, hey, we're going to help you get a program. So what I did when I got into this role was the other way around. I've asked programs to show me a level of interest first, and then we met them halfway. So that's what happened, for example, for Ukraine, for Hungary, for the Netherlands, for example. So we knew they had We knew they had club levels or they had individuals that were keen on growing the sport. So for example, they had already purchased the equipment or they were already training or they had introduction to the sport. So then it's easier for me to reach out to them and say, hey, I've seen this on social media. You're actively trying to get your program underway. These are our rules. These are our regulations. This is what you need to be aware in terms of classification. So who can play internationally versus who can play at the club level? Because one thing that is very important for us is that our eligibility criteria include a classification, a classification code, basically. So then we go to those people and say, here are all the information that you need. Continue to work at it. And then at the same time, we reach out to the National Paralympic Committee and we explain to them that we've been aware that there are individuals in their countries that are interested in playing the game. Basically, would you be interested in connecting with them, trying to see what their needs are? And then we start conversation like this. Sometimes those conversations are positive and the and, you know, it transforms into becoming a national programs. Sometimes for various reasons, there's no way to come to an understanding, and then they continue to play on their own, and we follow up later on to see if there's been any progress made. But that's how we were able to get teams, like I said, like Thailand, like Ukraine, which didn't exist before, and now are consistently performing with us. And we've had conversation, like I just mentioned, with Ukraine, with Hungary, with the Netherlands now that are doing something similar.
Now, I know that players, coaches, and officials always hate singling out certain other players, countries, processes. But just to give listeners here a better understanding, what might be the biggest success story of your tenure as World Para Ice Hockey Senior Manager? Is it Kazakhstan, where you say, I never saw this coming, and this is how you can develop a proper para ice hockey team fast? Or is there any other country that comes to mind first?
Of course, the feel-good stories are the Kazakhstan or the Thailand. I always say the first email I ever received on my IPC or World Para Ice Hockey email account was from Thailand. It was just an introduction. So I'm like, hi, my name is Brun Groth Chaman. I'm trying to start para ice hockey. What can I do? And this is where, again, it was my first week on the job. I had to build that, I call it a toolkit, where all the information can be accessed rapidly. Send it over to him and I said, hey, best of luck. Let's see what you can do with that. And we followed up a couple of times over the years. And 2 years later, you know, they applied to host the event. They had built an ice rink. They had recruited athletes. So that's one of my feel-good story. But equally, the thing I would say I'm the most proud of was the growth of our women's programs. So we didn't have women's teams. We didn't have women's events. The way our sport is structured is that at the A pool, B pool, C pool level, as well as the Paralympics, our sports are open. So this means that a woman may compete with the men. So it's not an exception to the rule. It's not something that is out of the ordinary. It is part of our rule. The only thing it says that you can have one additional player. So basically, if you have a woman on your team, you can have an additional player. There's no limit at how many women can be on the team. Somebody at the A pool could show up with an entire squad of women athletes. That would be fine. It wouldn't be against the rules. But the women were not making the roster. So that was an issue. So we had to find a way for women to know that they are allowed to play and that they are welcome to play. And also address the fact that maybe the model that we had wasn't working. So we had to look into what we were doing and find solutions, which is how we decided to create basically a pathway to the games. So we are aiming to go to the 2030 Paralympic Winter Games with a women's division. It's a very ambitious plan. We started sharing that information with the teams in 2020 to let them know that at the earliest it could happen was 2030, because we were not meeting any of the requirements that are set in place by the International Paralympic Committee. So we went from having 0.01% female in our sports to this year we are at 21% female that are playing para ice hockey. So that started in 2022. This was the first time we had a women's only competition or tournament. So in 3 years, we went from 0.01 to 21%. So that is really a great accomplishment. It is, again, I wish it was more. I wish we had more women's national program, but the fact that we are still able to deliver events every year that are aimed specifically to the women and to the growing the game, that's very important to us. At that event, we've had countries, for example, like Great Britain. Great Britain, their team is self-funded, so the athletes have to do fundraisers. They have to pay out of pocket for their training session, for their tournament fees, for the travel. So to have athletes that are so dedicated that they take their vacation days to come to tournaments, that they take all of their free time to go and train and try to grow the sport, because in 2022, when we announced this tournament, they officially had not a team and they got it together in just a few months. And since then, they've been very inclusive in having the women on the women's team be part of their open team. So because we started the Women's World Challenge and because Great Britain was able to send a team and also dress those same players for their open teams. We've had the first women, we've had the first goal scored by a women's at a world championship in Thailand in 22. We've had the first shutout by a women's goalkeeper at the world championship in Kazakhstan, which was also from Great Britain. So those are all, they're not small victories. They're huge victories because the sport has been around for 60 years and it had never happened before. And we've been able to do it in 3 years. So those are really moments that motivates not only myself, but also our on-ice officials or off-ice officials. Everybody's behind the movement and trying to grow the sport.
I want to talk about growth and how to grow the sport in a bit, but because of the fact that you mentioned that the women's program wasn't meeting any of the requirements of the International Paralympic Committee and that you gave them, like, you tried to set their sights on 2030. What are the requirements for para ice hockey of the International Para Committee?
So there's two things. I think what I should clarify is we were not meeting the criteria to apply to be part of the games. So currently the rules when we make an application for whether it's for the open team or any other team sports at the moment, and that's something that you can find online as well. But you would need, for example, for my sport, if it is a team sports at the winter games, whether it's the open division or in our hope to have a women's division, we need to have at a minimum 8 nations around the world that have a national program and that are regularly participating in para ice hockey events. So we need 8 countries, and they need to be from 3 different regions. So for example, North America is a region, Europe is a region, Asia is a region. So we need 8 countries from 3 regions, and then we need to have had 2 world championships when it's time to make the application. So when I started in 2020, they were, you know, teams were saying, oh, we should have a women's tournament in Beijing. I was like, well, that's way gone. Like the deadline for that was, I'm not saying I was in university when that deadline was set, but it was a long time ago. And then we were also too close to the application for Milano Cortina. So it takes a lot of times. Those decisions are made well ahead of time, which led us to this pathway of 10 years because we needed to know if there were any women playing. If they weren't playing, we needed to notify nations that they had to get those programs started and give them time to build their programs. So this is why we started first with the Women's World Challenge to see where the appetite for the sport was instead of jumping in straight away with a Women's World Championship that may not have been at the level it should have been. So we had a Women's World Challenge in 22, 23, 24. This year, we're moving forward with a Women's World Championship because we, like I said, we need to have had 2 World Championships by the time we do the application. The application should be around 2027 for 2030. So we, like I said, it's very ambitious, but it's a very long process and we cannot wait till the last second. And what I realize is that for our members, for our community, it is challenging to unlearn something versus learning something. And when we started to have those conversations with the teams, they were under the impression for some reason that basically the IPC could just decide to put in a tournament, no requirements whatsoever. They could just decide to do this and then let us in. So I had to go and really show them on the application, show them in the criteria that no, this is not just a decision that can be made. It is the International Federation's responsibility to meet the requirements. And right now we were not meeting the requirements. So it was a bit of a catch-22 where our members were waiting for the IPC to do something and the IPC were waiting for us to meet the criteria. So it was as simple as reading the instructions, really, and then telling the teams what the instructions were. So we're still sometimes facing those challenges again, where some people are sometimes reverting back to what they believed was the path to the game. So that's why for us, we keep reinforcing that, no, we have to continue with our pathway. We have to have our world championships and teams need to come up and support the women's programs.
Just to give listeners an idea, the status quo, how many countries are currently having a women's program in para ice hockey?
So at our last World Champion, I almost said the wrong thing. At our last Women's World Challenge, we had three national teams. So we had USA, Canada, Great Britain. However, since we've started the program, we've had teams, for example, like Korea, who has developed their national, who is actively developing their program. The last we spoke with them, they had eight women on their squad that were training year round. Something that also we should mention for para ice hockey is that unlike the IHF, our rosters are smaller. So for us to have a national team, the minimum requirements is 7+2. So 7 skaters and 2 goalkeepers. So we need 9 players. That makes it more accessible, I would say, for countries to come up with their national programs. And of course, as you develop and you get stronger and you get more visibility, the programs grow. So that's why in the open division, most of our teams are at the maximum of players allowed, which would be 15+2. And then in our smaller programs, then we're closer to our minimum range. So Korea started their programs in 2023. The last we spoke, they had, like I said, they had 8 players. They did send athletes to the last Women's World Challenge, because what we do to really encourage people or encourage women to continue with their training and try to advocate for themselves to have their programs in their countries, that we have continental teams. So the first 2 years of the Women's World Challenge, we had what we call a team world, where we had 1 athlete from Czechia, for example, 1 athlete from France, 3 from Sweden, I'm just giving example. And then we make a team with those athletes, and we support them by providing accommodation and coaching and uniforms. So this is what we've done in the past. In Norway this year, when we had the Women's World Challenge, we were able to get 2 continental teams. So we were able to get a Team Europe and a Team Pacific. So on Team Pacific, we had athletes from Japan, from Australia, from Korea. And then in Europe, we had Finnish athlete, Norwegian, Swedish, French, Czech. So those athletes then go back to their countries and try to recruit more to get their own team started. So in addition with Korea, we know that Australia have a significant amount of players that could potentially ice a team next year at our World Championships. We've had indication that there's a group in India that could potentially have enough players, but then it's all about introducing them to their Paralympic committee. So officially, we have 3 national teams, but it is likely that we would get more and more players. Norway, for example, was nearly at a full national team, or they were about to meet the national, the minimum criteria. Luckily for them, some of their players got pregnant. So it's great news for them. It impacted their national team program, but you know, this year they may be back and they may be able to ice a national team. So it's all about sharing the information with them and continuing to monitor their progress, but we're hopeful that we'll be able to meet our 8 team minimum criteria by 2027.
Now, the recruitment of players and athletes is an incredibly interesting thing. How much are you banking on word of mouth that someone who fell in love with the game tries to recruit other para athletes, and how much maybe does exposure in certain markets help to recruit new athletes to the sport?
Yes, for us, we've realized that it takes a village. And at the women's level, there's a great sense of community. So we try to make everybody feel welcome, because our goal is for them, like I said, to go back and try to grow the game. By dedicating an event every year to the women, that also increases the exposure. We've also done a lot of social media videos and engagement. Most recently, we started a recruitment campaign online where we're asking people who are interested in trying the sport to get in touch with us so that we can introduce them to their Paralympic committees. We've had people in the US, we've had basically some people in the US who were raising funds and paying for the travels of other countries to come to an event. We've had Canada who was helping out by collecting used equipment and shipping it across the world to people that they knew were interested in starting their program. So it's going to take everybody's help to get the women's to where it needs to be. And we're lucky, we're extremely lucky to have those people there who are stepping up and really looking out for each other and trying to grow the game.
Now, a little earlier, you talked about new federations or new participating countries with programs and you trying to educate them about eligibility criteria. And I'm asking this question specifically because in Austria to have teams, they kind of turned it around or switched or mixed things up a little bit, and healthy, not handicapped people can still participate in para ice hockey. Would that be possible on the international level as well? And if not, what specifically are the eligibility criteria?
Yeah, so for us, the way it works at the international level is that we need to be code compliant with the classification code. We have to follow our classification rules. In our rules, it says that in order to play para ice hockey, you must have an impairment of the lower body. So it can be anything from an amputation, it can be a neurological issue that prevents you from being able to use your legs. So for us, we're quite inclusive because our class is big in a sense. So it's not specific to one particular impairment. We try to bring in as much people as possible. When it comes to international competitions, that's the rules. Like that's not going to change. However, at the national level, at the club level, at the local level, we encourage people who may not have an impairment to play the sport and practice the sport, because that gives people that are hoping to make the national team more practice experience, more game experience. And it just allows them to train and enjoy the game more. So it gives them more experience. We've seen this in a lot of countries that have had clubs, and you can see the benefit of having that being part of the grassroots model, because para ice hockey is a team sport, and to be able to find in the same region 15 or 16 people that falls under that category that is within a reasonable driving distance from each other to train regularly or play regularly, it is one of the big challenge. You take a country, for example, like Canada, it's huge. It's the second biggest country in the world. So how are those national players supposed to play and train together on a regular basis? It's impossible. So they have to rely on local clubs or provincial clubs. And sometimes you just don't have enough athletes with impairments that would classify to fill those squads. So of course, people are welcome and should look into joining the sport to help people with impairment to really achieve the highest level of performance that they can.
We were talking about exposure, and that obviously starts with the bigger tournaments, mm-hmm. and obviously the World Championships still coming, the April World Championships still upcoming later in the year at the end of May in Buffalo. And of course, there's the Paralympic movement, and those are upcoming in a year from now as well. But let's start with the World Championships. And it doesn't matter if it's an A pool, B pool, or C pool World Championship. How's your checklist looking when a country applies to host a World Championship? Granted that it's a very different proposition to host a tournament for able-bodied people, and then hosting a tournament for Paralympic athletes who might have different needs in terms of hospitality, hotels, and everything. Just a quick little insight on your checklist for a tournament.
Yes, I mean, I think one thing we should address is that when it comes to hosting an event, it's open to everybody. So, of course, we understand that a team that is playing will be more likely to bid for it. But the way it works is that we just put out the application and we say, this tournament is available, who is interested to host? And then people apply for this, and then we review the application. Now, in terms of accessibility, that's our main focus. So the ice ring, that is a non-negotiable, that the field of play, which is the ice, it has to be accessible and it has to meet our standards. So the first thing that we have to do is make sure that we have clear benches in front of the players' benches, in front of the penalty boxes. So that is keys to really a good field of play. We also need to assure that the benches, whether it's the players or the penalty benches, are flush with the ice. So you could see at lower level events sometimes, although we haven't done it since I started, but prior to that, or we'll see that at non-world championships. You can see people with ramps, basically. So the venue is not fully accessible, so they use the ramps for the benches. For us, we don't think it's ideal at a world championships level, definitely not at a Paralympic, because it means that it impacts the way a coach would coach or manage his bench, because you basically can only switch players at a stoppage of play. If you're in a penalty, you have to wait for the penalty to be over, and then you have to wait for a stoppage of play so that a volunteer can put out the ramp for you to exit the benches. So it's not ideal because it impacts the sports directly. So we don't want to see that. So yes, the field of play has to be accessible. Then we move on to the dressing rooms. So we need accessible showers, we need accessible toilets. It doesn't have to be permanently accessible, but the hosts that are delivering the events need to make adjustments to their dressing rooms. Then we move on to transportation. The teams have to fly into the country or the city where the event takes place. But when they arrive on site, then they become guests of the host. And then the host has to provide buses. They have to provide transportation from the airport to the hotel, to the rink. So then it becomes about finding accessible coach buses or vehicles that can support the athletes to move from point A to point B. Then we move on to accommodation. So if you come in, for example, an eight-ball tournament, you'll come in with eight teams. Every team is going to have a different level of accessibility needs. You'll have some teams that will have, half of them will be wheelchair users. Another teams will have maybe one or two. And then in your wheelchair users, you'll have different level of support needs. So you'll have people that can transfer from their wheelchairs onto their seats. So that's going to impact the type of rooms they're going to get or the type of buses they're going to get. But then you also have people who cannot move from a chair to a seat. So that plays into the type of vehicles we would be getting for them. So those are all things that organizers need to consider when they are hosting the event, and whether it is at World Championships or even at the Paralympic Games. Like those are the things that we look for. So we need field of play accessibility. We need accommodation that can welcome a large amount of wheelchair users. We need bus companies that can support, again, delegations of 30 plus people, including maybe up to 12 wheelchair users on the same squad. Those are really the key requirements that we look out for. And then on top of that, you know, we would be looking at sport presentations and signage and media management. So you have what is the impairment requirements, and then you have what are the sports requirements as well.
This all sounds incredibly complicated. And I basically want to ask a little more about the arenas and the rinks. If you just had to give a rough estimate on how many arenas and rinks are really deemed accessible, what would that be?
So it's interesting that you're saying that, because we are doing a survey with our members, because we're asking them to identify how many accessible rinks they have in each country. So at the moment, I don't have that number, but where we play, basically in those 19 countries, not all of them have accessible rinks. So that is an interesting fact. So we have countries that we know the teams will be practicing the entire year on a non-accessible ice rink. And then they have to show up and play against teams that have practiced and trained and played on fully accessible rink. And that's going to impact their games, right? So for us, we know which countries don't have any ice rink that are accessible at all. And we're trying to help them fix that issue, because it does impact their performances. But like that being said, if I had to say at the top of my head, I don't think I could give a general number, because our countries are so different, and the reality of each country is very, very different.
Maybe let me rephrase it a little bit. I mean, there are new arenas built left and right, and rinks that get a renovation of some kind. Do you get the feeling that accessibility is more at the forefront now when thinking or building new rinks than it was maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because we see it for para ice hockey, but there's also in general, like the there's a bigger movement in the world that is not specific to sport. Because yes, for us, we need accessible ice rink for our players, for our sports that we love. But Arena needs accessible ice rink for the general community. If I'm a grandma bringing my grandkid to play stand-up hockey, I may still need a lift. I may still need doors that open themselves because I'm carrying a toddler, I'm pushing a stroller, I'm carrying a hockey bag. So accessibility is not specific to athletes. And that, I think, more and more people are understanding that making accessible venue is beneficial to the entire community. It's not just for the sport of para ice hockey. Really, if you have an ice rink and you're making renovation, you should consider your entire base of people that come and use your facility. For us, like I said, yes, it would be much easier if all of the rinks would be accessible, and we hope more people will make those changes. And that's what we tell them. Like, we have to live in a more inclusive world in general. And if we can play more para ice hockey, even better.
So if there is anyone out there who's trying to build a new rink or thinking about building a new one, make it accessible. It will help you grow your business. When we talk about business, you're not only in the business of hosting world championships or providing help in hosting world championships and tournaments. There's also the small little thing of the Paralympic tournament happens every 4 years after the Winter Olympics. How does organizing Paralympic tournaments differ, or maybe is the same than when you think about hosting world championships? Are there differences, or is it the same?
There are differences, which is, sometimes it makes me laugh, because when you think about the Paralympics, of course you think it's bigger, because it is, it's huge. It's many different sports. It's the biggest window that we can get, the biggest exposure that we are currently getting. But there's also so many more resources available at the games. So the organizing committee has many more staff or volunteers. Also, our responsibilities as an IF are slightly different, because we, like I said, we have to apply to the games. The games are owned by the international, well, not owned, but they are under the governance of the International Paralympic Committee. So we have to work with them, basically. So we do have a lot of supports. We also have limitation in our roles that we have to do at our world championships. So, for example, at a world championships, we have to be in charge of the sport, but then I also have to oversee, of course, the sports, the results, the rules, the regulations, but also the live streams, the broadcasts, the script for the game. So, you know, things like, hello, welcome to the game against Austria and Thailand, like all of these have to be written and produced and reviewed on a day-to-day by me on site, basically. Same thing with doing interviews with the players, editing video, so overseeing our photographers, videographers, listening to the live stream, giving feedback to the commentators. We're very much more hands-on, because it's ours. The World Championships are our baby. We want to make it our own, and we want to oversee everything. And then at the Paralympic Games, it's our tournament, but we're part of a bigger picture. So there's a lot more conversations and negotiations, whether it's about the competition schedule, for example. Okay, if it was a world championship, maybe I would have put our day off on this specific day. But now I have to account for the fact that for broadcast, it may not be best for the Paralympics for me to have this day, because otherwise there won't be anything on TV. So, okay, let's move this game to this specific day, or this sport will want to have their gold medal on this day. So, okay, so I'll move my gold medal day to a different day. So it's more about playing with others and making sure that we get the most out of it, but also that the movement can shine, and then the other sports can also get what they deserve. And then when it's our world championships, It's ours from beginning to end. So we're much more involved with opening ceremonies, medal ceremonies, the type of awards we want to give. So that's one thing that we do differently, for example, would be victory ceremonies. At a world championship, we would recognize the athletes, but also the coaching staff. We also recognize our on-ice officials. We'll also give awards to the best player of the game. So those are things that we have the liberty to do at a World Championships because we own them versus at the games we have to go under the IPC's rules and regulations and protocol.
But then again, what's the busiest time for you during the calendar year? Is it two weeks away from the World Championships? Is it during the World Championships? Is it a year away from the Paralympics? How does one have to think about this?
Well, what's interesting is that being an IF that has only one dedicated staff, busy season is all the season. But it's at event time, the way I work and the way I like to plan my thing is I like everything to be ready for a specific event on by the time I get there, so that when I get there, everything should be fine. And then I can troubleshoot if something goes wrong, which of course things would. There was last minute emergencies and there was last minute changes. But that's why I don't want to have work to be, I don't want to have tasks, specific tasks when I'm at an event, because I should be troubleshooting. And if everything is fine, everything is working well, then I can start working on my next event. So usually a month before the event, that's when it gets busy because all the documents have to be produced. You have to do the accreditations, the schedules, and it's not just the game schedule, because people are like, okay, like the game schedule is done, that's it. But then you need to add the practice schedule, the media schedule, the meeting schedule. You need to do classification. You need to look at the big picture and make sure there's no conflict in of everything that's going on happening at the same time. So there's a lot of things to be done. And then when there's downtime, you want to be, again, working on development and you want to be working on outreach and getting new people. So there's not a lack of things to be done. There's a lot of things that can, you know, I can always find myself something to do, that's for sure. But it's amazing. It's probably the best gig I've ever had. And you get to meet so many incredible people when you go to those events that you're looking forward to those crazy busy days of, you know, waking up at 6 and going to bed at 3, because it's worth it. It's absolutely fantastic.
And you've got a great staff and obviously helping set up this interview, Rafael Maranao, I'm probably butchering his name right now. He was tremendously helpful as well. And there's so many good people working in your team. And I've already mentioned the big one coming up with the World Championships. So your April and May are looking mightily busy. How can these World Championships in Buffalo 2025 be followed? On recent or during recent tournaments, everything was free to air and live to stream on YouTube. Is it going to be the same for Buffalo 2025?
So right now, if you go on the website, you'll see that more details is still to come, because we're looking at international markets. So it may differ where you are in the world. So that's why right now I wouldn't be able to give you a specific location for you to watch depending on where you are in the world. But as we get closer to the event, we will be publishing where the live stream is going to be available to be seen.
Reason why I'm asking is because we're about to quote unquote celebrate the Equal Play Day. That's a day that was kind of founded or brought to life by this podcast's main sponsor, Win Today. It's the day where women in sports are invisible until the end of the year when compared to men's sports. So basically 14% of sports coverage is about women's sports. Only 1% of the sports coverage is about para athletes. So their Equal Play Day happens basically at the very beginning of the year. And we're talking about growth and we're talking about exposure. And we're trying to help create an understanding of the para ice hockey movement. But what are your measures of success in terms of growth of the sport? Is it just the sheer countries that are participating, or is it indeed about viewers on broadcast?
So of course we would like, I mean, for us, it's an easy number to get is a number of athletes, a number of countries. So that's for us. And also, again, our sport is to grow the sport, to get more athletes involved in the sport. That being said, it would be nice and it should be that the spectators may not have, like I said earlier in the podcast, they may not have a skin in the game. So right now, our community or the people who are mainly involved or following the sport, I'm not saying all of them are, but the majority are, the majority of the people that are following the sport is because they know someone in the sport, right? They know whether it's a brother or cousin, or they know somebody's nephew or niece that is playing the sport. That's how they get involved with the sport. The casual hockey fan, or maybe like an NHL fan that doesn't know anybody in para ice hockey or in para sports, may not be following the sport. And for us, what it's hilarious is that when you show those I call them casual hockey fan, or your generic hockey fan, when you show them para ice hockey, their first reaction is always, "Oh, it's just like ice hockey," and you're like, "Yeah, it's just like ice hockey." And then 5 minutes later, they're like, "But wait a second, like, how are they doing this? How can they do this in the sledges right now?" Like, you can see their brain shifting, because at first they're a bit impressed by what they're doing, and then they think it's normal because it's just like hockey, and then they really start thinking about what they're seeing and how, you know, a Canada US game, a para ice hockey Canada US game is, in my opinion, no different than a, you know, world championship or Olympic men or women Canada US game. Like, the level is incredible. It's remarkable. It's so good. And yeah, like, they still have to skate with their arms, and they still have to play with both hands at the same time. It's amazing. But we need to get in front of those people. We need to show them that if you're an ice hockey fan, surprise, you're also a para ice hockey fan. You just don't know about it yet. The challenge, however, just like everything, whether it's growth of the sports or whether it's recruitment or development, becomes the funding. Producing a hockey game or doing a live stream, it's not the cheapest thing to do. So sometimes we have to make hard decisions where, okay, we may or may not have commentators for this specific tournament, or we may have to skip graphics, or we may have to only do live streams. So live stream is accessible, and we like doing that. It's a safe way for us to be in front of people, but it's still not television. But again, the market is changing. People are not consuming sport the way that they used to. It's not often now that people are sitting in front of their TV just flicking through the channels, right? With digital media and online platforms, the way we consume sporting event has changed. So we have to continue to explore what is out there for us. But yeah, in an ideal world, we should be in prime time. You know what I mean? Like, our sport is amazing, and more people should see that. Now, we have to find a way to make that happen. Right now, our resources are limited, so that's not something we can do. But if it's going, finding partners, finding extra fundings to do that, that's definitely something we're always on the lookout for and would always consider.
And you touched on a great point, and I promise I'll keep this within an hour, as your time is incredibly valuable. But anyone who first sees para hockey and then starts, like, trying to understand what's going on, the skill it takes to stand upright in a sledge and to work just with your hands is incredible. So all the athletes out there who are indeed para ice hockey athletes, tremendous amounts of respect to you. And again, those can be seen at the very highest level at the Buffalo 2025 World Para Ice Hockey Championships. And the past two decades basically have been all Canada and the USA, basically the US being the country that won five of the last six Paralympic Games. Now Canada reigning world champion, won on home soil. The Americans won in Canada two editions ago. Why do Canada and the US have the best male Paralympic or para hockey teams?
Yeah, I mean, Canada and US have been dominant, and they've been dominant for many years.
I mean, it's the same in stand-up hockey and women's hockey. I understand that, but why in para ice hockey specifically?
At the same time, recently, we've had Czechia, we've had China, that's, you know, it's breathing down the neck, could be breathing down the neck of those teams. The semifinals last year, at one point, Czechia was leading against the US. Canada and China had a close couple of periods. So you never know, things could flip. But yeah, Canada and the US, they have strong programs. They have a strong organizational structure. They've been dominant at all level, whether it's men, women, juniors, women's juniors. They have good infrastructure. They also have a very large pool of people to select from. So that increases the competition level internally for them. We have countries that, you know, they have 14 athletes on their national teams list because there's 14 athletes in the entire country. So in Canada and the US, you have hundreds of players to pull from. I'm not saying that's the only reason, but they also have ice rink. They have a hockey culture. The hockey IQ is recognized because they are exposed to it from a very young age. So they have a lot of coaches or staff or managers that can be there to assist. So they do have a lot of maybe they have more access to support. That being said, it's still possible for other teams to come and surprise us. So we see it. I mean, we don't see it like right now at the top of the A pool, but the other teams, it's anyone's games basically for the other positions. One thing that the other countries can do, and a lot of them have started doing, is looking at what Hockey Canada and USA Hockey are doing. You see a lot of what we call approved competition, where Czechia and China are going to play against to see how they're doing and just continue to play against each other throughout the season. Yeah, but I think everybody's on, everybody's going to be number one, number two, number three, and then you never know what's going to happen. We've had countries that were ahead of the USA and Canada for many years that are now bottom of the A pool or even at the B pool. It always depends on the support you get at home and the progression that you have. You also cannot wait and bank on what you have on the ice right now. Teams should always be looking at recruiting and onboarding more athletes, because we've seen countries that have just waited for their national teams to age out and then they have to start from the bottom. I think Canada and the US have done a good job at bringing in new athletes and having them share the ice with more veteran athletes. So it's about continuing to go out there and find the best talent that you can.
Now, with the World Championships on the horizon in Buffalo at the end of May, a nice development happened in December of 2024, because the Salt Lake City Paralympic Champions of 2002, they were joining, or it was announced that they would be joining, the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. And that Hall of Fame has been around since the 70s, and the first para-ice hockey team to join that Hall of Fame. What does something like that do for the recognition of para-ice hockey?
I think it's a fantastic initiative, what they've done. And I think other countries should look at it as an example or something to do to be more inclusive of their para-ice hockey program. Because yes, USA had a great team and they have been recognized, but there are a couple of teams that internationally that could receive the same amount of recognition from their national federation. That being said, not all national federations are overseeing the development of their national team. Like we had discussed earlier, NPCs sometimes are, I mean, all NPCs are the governing forces of those teams, but then they sometimes delegate the day-to-day operations to national federations or third-party organizations. So to see USA Hockey being that inclusive is really proof of how they consider their athletes and how they treat their athletes. They know that they have to be treated just like their stand-up hockey players. And it takes time, but I think by having USA do this, I think other countries are gonna look at it and try to do something similar in the future.
I think if we learn anything the past hour, then that it's a great time to start following para ice hockey. I'm so thankful that you not only took such extensive time, but also educated the listeners and myself about the great sport of para ice hockey. Wishing you all the best for the World Championships in Buffalo, for the Paralympics in Italy next year. Thank you so much for doing this. Already looking forward to having you on the podcast another time soon.
Great. Thank you so much.
Win today, Hockey O'Clock.
kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn.
Und das ging rasend schnell.
Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt.
Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Fans, stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh.
Nice move, another nice move. Oh,